In 2003, Cilla Black spoke to Five Live's Simon Mayo about her autobiography, What's It All About? And I listened to this last night and I just thought it very much is relevant to today after Cilla's death. And in the interview, Cilla discusses how she got her break, being friends with the Beatles, and the impact of the death of Bobby, her husband of 30 years. So I think this gives you an insight into the person behind the celebrity. Really, really worth listening to this morning. Cilla began talking to Simon about discussing her long-lasting appeal and explained why she was able to engage with audiences from all different kinds of age groups.
Well, I do, because they've all been weaned on me doing television. I mean, I'm celebrating also this year 40 years in show business. So all the kids on Blind Date. I mean, I remember interviewing one little girl on the show. She was 18. She said, you know, it's always been my ambition to appear on Blind Date. I said, well, how long have you had this ambition? She said, since she was 8. Because, you see, people forget that Blind Date was running for 18 years, which was virtually like a soap opera, really, when you think about it. I had the best times on there too. I had the best time ever. It wasn't work.
Were you slightly disappointed at the way it ended? I mean, you made that fantastic. I mean, you couldn't have made it up. Put it in a movie, it would have been sensational. You know, for a live edition, and then you say, "That's it. I'm not going to do anymore." But were you disappointed about the little changes that they'd made and the silly little format, little alterations that they'd done?
Very much so. That's why I took the big decision, and I didn't take it lightly. I mean, I didn't even know before the show what my son Robert had organised. A press release. My daughter-in-law was going to send it down the line on computer to all the press. And I said to Robert just before the show, because I didn't tell anybody, not my nearest and dearest friends, who were all in the audience that night. And I just said to Robert, look, if I don't make this announcement in the first 10 minutes, you know I'm not going to do it. I have to do it at the top of the show and get it out the way. I remember saying to my producer, and I swear to God, I said, look, I may go off on a tangent here. I might sort of say stuff, but I will come back to the job in hand. It's not because it's a live show. I'm so used to doing live television. And I was weaned on live television anyway. I said, I might do this. And, I heard the opening music to Blind Date and I thought, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. I was terrified, but I did do it. And I thought it was the best way to do it. And luckily enough, because I thought, this could either be the most unprofessional thing I've ever done in my life. And one thing you can't accuse me of is being unprofessional, because I take what I do very, very seriously. I work very hard at making what I do look dead easy.
Do you remember how the opening of the show went, what you said?
Oh, I just welcomed everything. No, it's all a blur. I can remember every movement of the audience all looking round in slow motion going, did she really say that? What did she say? And even my crew, all in slow motion. And I looked up to Robert, who was sitting at the back of the studio audience, and he just gave me the thumbs up sign. I thought, I can relax now. Let's do it. Let's do the show. I've made the announcement. Let's do the show and enjoy it.
Let's go back to the very early days, which is where your book starts, growing up in Liverpool.
Yeah.
And the whole thing about the Catholic-Protestant divide, which of course, yeah, I know about but had completely forgotten, and I think the first chapter's called Left Footer.
Yeah.
So were you very much aware of the Catholic-Protestant...
Totally.
..at school?
Totally at school. We were at war with the Protestants. We were totally at war. I never quite understood it, because I've always liked people for what they are, not because of their religion. And it was really inbred in me to be... I was brought a very strict Catholic. And there used to be one road that separated, well, a street, but it was a very long street. The Catholics were on one side and the Protestants were on the others. And, you know, they called us left footers and we called them proddy dogs. Terrible, isn't that awful? Yeah. And I used to go and on the 12th of July up to Netherfield Road with my other Catholic friends to shout obscenities, which I didn't. I mean, I did shout, but secretly, I just loved the marches. I absolutely loved the music. And to this day, I know all the words to The Sash My Father Wore. I love that song. I adored that song. And so I think, you know, we had our own little island in Scotland Row, in Liverpool, Ireland's always had the problem, but we had ours too. I mean, Bobby, my husband, was a Protestant. And I remember the first words out of my mother's mouth when I brought him home. And she looked at him and ignored him and said to me, "He looks as if he'll make a good Catholic." And of course, Bobby was agnostic. He was a Protestant. He was agnostic.
An agnostic Protestant.
Yeah, well, he didn't know what he was, really. He was at school. He did go to a Protestant school. But, I mean, even in those days, I mean, Liverpool and Everton, the two great football teams, my father was an Evertonian, because if you were a Catholic, you supported Everton. And if you were a Protestant, you supported Liverpool. I mean, even that's...
It's a lot better now, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's amazing, because Bobby had a couple of brothers, and I've got three brothers, and it's amazing how... Bobby's brothers, including himself, all married Catholics.
Has the Catholicism stayed with you?
It did do. And then when I lost Bobby, I mean, I used to talk to God every night. You know, I used to thank. It was funny, really, because Bobby used to go mad. He used to think I was doing it to really have a go at him, but I wasn't. And because I used to thank God every night, you know, for making me a success out loud. And then a couple of times I'd say, "Why me?" And then I'd go, "Oh, no, God. No, no, no. No, God, don't tell me why. Just keep on doing what you're doing, but thank you anyway." And then I'd say stuff like, "Good night and God bless." I said, "Well, I don't have to say God bless because you are God." You know, it was silly. It was really silly. But no, I've not spoken to God since Bobby died, because I've fallen out with him, basically. I thought it was the worst thing when Bobby, you know, that could happen to me ever. I mean, I've had a lot of bad things happen to me, but, you know, to take the love of my life away from me, that was just, I didn't like that one iota.
There's obviously a lot of success in the book, which we'll talk about in just a second, but I was struck by the amount of sadness that is in there.
Yeah.
Was it easy to write about? I mean, you write about miscarriage and you write about losing your daughter, who'd only been alive for a couple of hours.
Yes.
Various accidents to the family, and obviously losing Bobby. Still very soon to be writing about that.
Well, it was, but it just felt right, the right time. It was like it was the right time, you know, to give up Blind Date. I'm celebrating also 40 years in show business this year. And I've never really felt old enough before to write an autobiography, but it was my eldest son, Robert, who said, "You know, Mother, you know, you really have to leave a legacy." And I said, "Well, I'm not going anywhere just yet, Robert. I'm not planning anything just yet." But it is the right time. It was the right time. And yet, you know, writing about Bobby's illness and indeed everything that's happened to me in my life, it was not going to be an easy job anyway.
The first number one, 1964.
Well, that was Anyone Out of Heart, yeah.
Yeah, I remember hearing... Art Garfunkel say nothing ever, anything in his life, has beaten the first number one, which for him was Sounds of Silence.
Oh, right.
1965 is a long time ago. I suspect you've had many other highs since then, but that must have been an extraordinary feeling. Did you have any highs that were bigger than that?
No, not really. I mean, I was brought down, you know, with heavy feet to the ground straight away, because, I mean, you've got to remember there was the Beatles at the time and there was Jerry, and I think I was working with Jerry. I was actually in Liverpool, and Brian Epps, we didn't have a telephone in my house, and he wanted to, we always talked at a certain time of the day, and I had to go to the bus stop where I'd catch the 27 bus into town to the Cavern and stuff. And there was a telephone kiosk. And that's how I heard about I'd reached number one with Heart. He phoned a local telephone box and I answered it and he gave me the news.
And you say in your book, this is a telephone box that smelt of wee.
Oh, yes.
This is not a very showbiz way to find out that you're number one in the UK.
Well, I mean, that's where I lived, in Liverpool. And I became, you know, a star overnight, really. I mean, it was just absolutely amazing, absolutely incredible. But one that was totally expected from me, because since the age of three, when my parents used to stand me on the kitchen table, I had an audience now and they would applaud when I'd sing. And I thought, wow, this is good. I want some of this. And then my mother used to take me to see the pictures to see people like Doris Day, and Doris Day would talk and sing and talk about, you know, the yard Well, the yard in America was 3 acres of green lawn, whereas my yard in Liverpool is where we kept the coal and the loo. The loo was the outside loo. You know, and I wanted some of that, and I desperately wanted it.
The Beatles, and just runs through the whole book. In fact, if you look at the index, the amount of references to the Beatles, I mean, there's loads and loads.
Well, they were my mates. What
exactly.
Can I say?
Well, I think that was the greatest bit when you're talking about. We know an awful lot about your relationship with the Beatles, but it was the fact that you knew them so well that when Beatlemania hit, you were all going, but that's Richard Starkey. I know they're good, but listen to that screaming. It was the fact that you couldn't quite believe that it had happened to these guys who were your friends.
Well, neither could they. You have to remember the boys as well, because they couldn't believe it. And they hated it. They hated all the screaming. They hated that. I mean, they loved all the other pleasantries, like, you know, all the groupies and stuff. But they hated the screaming because they were musicians and they wanted to be heard and they were writers and they wanted their songs to be appreciated. They hated it. When I appeared with them, which was the best time for me, at Finsbury Park Empire, and it was just before Christmas, and Brian Epstein actually hired a plane to take us all home for Christmas. The boys were not happy there. Because it was just one long scream. I mean, they could have gone on and just mimed, you know, because you couldn't hear anything. Just one long scream from the audience.
Which hadn't actually happened before, had it? Not like that in this country.
No, well, yeah, well, they did have Cliff, of course. It did happen with Cliff Richard, because, I mean,
Quite at the same volume?
I think. Well, no, not... Well, yes, actually, it was, because I was one of those kids that... I mean, I remember at school waiting out. Cliff was playing the Royal Philharmonic in Liverpool, and I waited outside. I didn't go in to see the show. I thought I'll wait outside in a taxi because I couldn't afford both. And literally, who I thought was Cliff jumped into a limo, and I literally said, "Follow that car." And I was so disappointed. It wasn't Cliff at all. It was Jimmy Tarbuck. And so I followed Jimmy Tarbuck home.
That's a bit of, I mean, no disrespect, but, you know, he's not quite as sexy as Cliff was.
No,
really.
No. I mean, really, Cliff Richard
for me, anyway.
Really would be the only man I would have divorced Bobby for. I think he's just so gorgeous.
Did he know that?
Of course I told him all the time.
And there's a couple of other Beatles things that just stood out. First of all, that you were offered. I mean, it would appear to some people who grew up in the 60s that, you know, if you were offered to take drugs with the Beatles, that would be an extraordinary moment. But you weren't impressed, were you, really?
I couldn't get over, Simon? I mean, the first time that I did, I didn't try it, actually. I have tried, yeah, I did smoke. Yes, I
made
inhaled. I did have a couple of spliffs, I think, but I was a singer and I wanted to protect my voice. So if you're a non-smoker, it kind of doesn't appeal to you. And actually, I had a mouth on me like Lily Savage after I swore, and I don't swear either. Swearing doesn't suit me like it suits Lily. It doesn't suit me at all. No, I wasn't very impressed. The main thing that turned me off was I was at a party and the boys were there. And, you know, this really long cigarette came round. I thought it was so unhygienic. I thought, there's no way I'm shoving that thing in my gob. I'm not going to do it. I don't want to do it. And so I was the one, I was the odd one out. And I felt the odd one out. And I didn't actually made my excuses and left the party. But, hey, I can't help being the way I am.
No. After your burglary, mm-hmm. did you not have similar thoughts, you know, thoughts?
Oh, for 24 hours, Simon, I wished every deadly disease, not only on them, on their family, and then 24 hours later, I was just so upset that I could think these things. And no, I don't think that now. I'm just, what I think now. Sorry?
What were you thinking?
At the time,
mm-hmm.
I just wished them every worst possible thing that you could wish on anybody, on your worst enemy. And I just felt so ashamed of myself. But I think that's natural anyway. I mean, it took 24 hours for me to say, oh, hey, I feel... this is to myself when I'm talking to myself. There are better things in life to worry about than that. Now I'm just angry. I'm angry that they... I took a knife to my son's throat and threatened to kill him if they didn't get what they wanted. You know, I'm so proud of Jack for being very brave. He did have a go, which was foolish, but that was a natural reaction. He was hit with a crowbar. I mean, it's very graphically. I mean, he was overwhelmed by three of them, and they had him face downwards on the floor with his hands handcuffed behind his back and a knife to his throat. And in the circumstances, from what I've heard from Robert and Ben and Jack, is that he really reasoned with these guys. I can't believe that. Doesn't take after me, definitely takes after his father, because look, you can take the girl out of Liverpool, but you can't take the Liverpool out of the girl. I mean, I know I would have lost it. I really would have lost it. And it would be so out of character for me, but I know I would have done that.
And that would have been far more dangerous, really. Is he okay now?
He's fine. He's very resilient. He's great. You know, obviously there can be a long-term reaction to this. I mean, I was, when I heard the news, I was in Portugal with Cliff, actually. And I was shaking. I've never experienced shock like that before in my life. Shock. And I haven't even had time to think about the jewellery, which even they took my wedding ring, which is very upsetting. Why wasn't I wearing my wedding ring? Because I have arthritis on my wedding finger and it was just too small for me.
We were talking on the programme a couple of weeks ago about restorative justice, when people who've suffered from crimes like that actually get to meet the people who committed the crimes. Would that...
God, no. Well, my first reaction... Oh, no, 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 no. I told you, you can take the girl out of Liverpool, you can't take the Liverpool out of the girl. No, you'd have to have paramedics standing by.
That's not for you, then?
Not for me. Definitely not for me.
What for the future, Scylla? There's a couple of interesting lines in your book where you talk about, first of all, opening a nightclub.
That is going ahead.
That's going to happen, because Bobby never wanted you to do that.
Sorry?
Bobby wasn't a fan of that, was he?
He would have said, what's the point? But hey, this is my time and I can have fun, and I am.
Where did that positive attitude come from? Because you would be quite entitled to just say, well, it's been great and I'm just, you know, I'll stop doing blind date. That was the right time. I'll just enjoy myself. I'll travel the world and
I can still enjoy myself and open a club, can't I? What's stopping me doing that anyway? I mean, I'm doing stuff that is fun for me. And I've not really closed down television either. I just want to celebrate my 40 years in show business. And doing that, I've done the book and I've done a CD and I'm so proud of that, which is great. And also the docu for Channel 4. And then I will sort of have another hot... I'm going to Cuba for 3 days. Everybody thinks I'm going to live in Cuba. Why? I don't know.
I didn't know that.
It was in the... I'm taking a gap year, they said, and I'm going to be living in Cuba. I have never been to Cuba, but I've no doubt... I think 3 days would be enough in Cuba for me. And next year, maybe I might do another TV show. Maybe.
What sort of a TV project would interest you when you've done Surprise, Surprise, when you've done Blind Date, which, although I must say I felt very sorry for Duncan Norvell when I read in the book that he was the guy who did the pilot for Blind Date.
Yeah, I did too.
And then but he did the pilot that didn't get chosen.
Now, let me get this perfectly clear about Blind Date. I had Surprise, Surprise, and so I didn't think at that time, because when Surprise, Surprise went on air, it blanketed the whole nation and took everybody... Literally, it took the whole audience by storm and they loved it. Everybody loved it. So what do I want trying out another TV show for? And am I capable of doing two shows at the same time? And so when I saw Duncan Orvell, the show that he did, which was fabulous, and they said, well, he can't, because he did have that catchphrase, chase me, chase me, which he... basically put on a camp act and made out that he was gay, and of course he wasn't gay at all. And they didn't think that would sustain through a whole series. It was a weak thing. And in a word, what they said to me, the only way we can get this, because the IBA wouldn't pass it, it was called the, whatever it was called at the time, And they said, you know, the only way we can get this past the powers that be is if we get you to do the show. Because we thought, who is the most sexless person on telly? And it was me.
Not true.
I think what they meant was that I wouldn't offend anybody. But they could have put it another way, couldn't they?
Thanks for the messages and emails. You've got a big fan club out there, Scylla. A couple of questions then still with Scylla here. Nick Mitford in Newcastle. Do you think, Scylla, that the huge viewing figures the programmes like Blind Date and Noel's House Party pulled in are a thing of the past and that Saturday night television will never hit such levels of success again?
Well, of course it will, because we're multi-channel now. We didn't have that much choice, did we really? Although Blind Date did, because we still had the extra channels. But no, the face of television has totally changed. And reality television is here to stay.
So what would entice you back? It would have to be a very, very strong format or completely different.
It would have to. It would. You know when an idea is right for you, because it jumps right off the page. You know, I usually find it's the simplest of programmes that really are the most successful. It's when people try and shove in too many ideas in a show. It's when they're not sure. And I would just go for the simple format, because you can always improve on that as you go along anyway.